sunshine meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
A very good evening and welcome along to Sunshine Meets. I'm Andrea Hayes. My guest tonight is one of Ireland's leading child protection experts. He's a journalist, musician and teacher, but he's probably best known as an international best-selling author, known worldwide for a series of books detailing cases he was involved in, both as a social worker and journalist. Sunshine Meets Shane Dunphy. You're very welcome to the Sunshine Studio.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here. I can't believe that's all me.
That is all you. And you know what we always do, Shane? We're going to start at the beginning. Can you tell our guests a little bit about where you were born and life growing up for the younger years of Shane?
Okay, I was born in Brighton in England. My dad is from Wexford Town. And he had gone to the UK originally to work with Glyndebourne Opera House. He was one of the volunteers in the Wexford Festival Opera back in the 60s, I suppose it must have been. And he did very well. He was kind of he's very keen, I think. He's always been a huge fan of opera. And the Glyndebourne Touring Company came over one year to do one of the operas, don't ask me which one. And they offered him a job. Apparently they offered him and a couple of other guys the opportunity to go back to the UK with them and work at Glyndebourne Opera House. And I think my dad was the only one who actually took them up on it. And so he literally followed his dream. I always say he ran away to join the opera. You know the way people run away to join the circus? My dad ran away to join the opera. And that led on to him. I think he had probably thought he would eventually work his way up to becoming an opera singer, because he can sing, he's got a great voice. But I don't think that quite happened. And I think as well, the salary was probably pretty crap. So I think he had a great time touring around with them and putting on operas all over England and working in the big opera house itself. But eventually he got a job as a technician in a school in Brighton. So he was the guy that set up the slide projectors and fixed plugs when they didn't work and all that kind of thing, because he's always been very handy like that. And he met my mum there. She was a teacher in the school, and they fell in love, and I think I was the result of that. I was the first result of that. So we lived in Brighton until I was about a year and a half old, and then he got the opportunity to go back to Ireland. Hassett's Chemist, which is still in operation on the main street in Wexford, offered him a job. They were starting off a kind of a photography department, and he's always been quite good with that. So they came back to Wexford, and that's more or less where they've been since.
And that's where you have lived.
Yeah, I mean, we travelled around, my wife and I, kind of when we immediately qualified after college. We kind of traipsed around the country for a little while following the work. But in 2003, we kind of came back and settled in Wexford. And that's where we've been since.
Now, you've skipped a few years there.
I have skipped a few years. I've jumped over.
Life sort of 18
months to 30 has been jumped over, yeah.
So life in Wexford, you obviously love Wexford. Tell us a little bit about your years in school, and then what preceded you meeting your wife and where you both met?
Right, school, I loved primary school. I think I was blessed to have some really good teachers, and I suppose I would trace my love of books and writing probably goes back to my mother. My mother was a hugely influential person in my life. I suppose mothers are in most people's lives, but I would tend to kind of blame her for most of the things I became later. We grew up in a house where everybody read, and she would have read to us every night before bed, and she would have continued to do so long after we could all read for ourselves. And my abiding memory of childhood is myself snuggling up to her on one side and my brother on the other, and her reading, you know, Enid Blyton and A.A. Milne and Michael Bond, the Paddington books and Richmal Crompton. It was very English. My mum was very English, spoke like a BBC continuity announcer, and had one of the most beautiful voices to be read to that I've ever encountered. And that sort of spilled over into my, I think, just naturally, you know, I loved books so much that if there was something that wasn't in a book, I would just write my own. And I would have started writing my own stories probably when I was in senior infants. So, I mean, we're talking 6 or 7, I think, probably. And then when I got into second class, I had a teacher, Mr. Goff, who became the principal of Scullwera School, just up the road from where I grew up. And he was the first teacher who really pushed me. He would kind of get me to, he would give me an idea. Here, why don't you write about this? And he would send me off to write it. And I would come back to him with these copybooks full of, you know, densely densely written lines, and I don't know whether he ever read them or not, but at least he pretended that he did and told me that they were wonderful. So primary school was great. I remember Paddy Ryan, who's actually he presents the traditional Irish music programme on South East Radio now. Paddy was another guy who really encouraged us, and he was one of the first teachers who kind of showed me that writing wasn't just books. He would have introduced me to the music of Noel Coward and people like that, and, you know, listen to the language, you know, listen to the language in those lyrics and those songs. And Paddy would have really kind of pushed me towards music as an outlet as well. Secondary school, I didn't like so much. I was growing up in Wexford around the time that a lot of the sort of clerical abuse was going on, which I think certainly pushed me towards child protection as a career. Now, I was very lucky in that in secondary school I was a day student, so I was getting to go home in the evenings, but I had a lot of friends who didn't have that privilege, and excuse me. So we were kind of aware, a lot of us as kids, about things that were going on that weren't right. And it wasn't until I actually met my wife, and I remember I was having a conversation with her one evening, and we were just talking about our experiences in school and stuff that I just accepted as being, this is what happens when you're in school. She said, well, do you realize that that's not right, that those things shouldn't happen, and that didn't happen everywhere, that that was very peculiar to your experience? And it was kind of like a light bulb going on over my head. You know, actually what was going on wasn't right. And I think that that was a watershed moment for me, where I realised, well, maybe these things shouldn't happen, and maybe people should try and actually do something about it.
And that's your wife, Deirdre.
Deirdre, yes.
That you mentioned. Yeah. Now, tell us a little bit about how yourself and Deirdre met.
Deirdre and I met when I was 17, and I went... I reached a point in my teenage years where I wanted to either be a rock musician or nothing else. That was it. This was the Ireland of the 80s, where U2 were the biggest band in the world, and Ireland was awash with A&R men. Excuse me. And I was in a band called Local Contract. We were kind of like a folk rock band. We sort of were taking our inspiration from like the Waterboys, who were also in Ireland recording Fisherman's Blues at the time. And so combine the Waterboys with U2, I suppose, and you kind of get a sense of where we were trying to go. And we'd had some moderate success. I remember waking up one morning to hear Jerry Ryan playing one of our songs on his radio program, and I thought, that was it, I've arrived now, that I don't ever have to do anything else in my life, I've achieved this. My mother actually said to me, you know, you might need a backup plan. There's a slim chance you won't get an international record deal and become the next Bono, so you better come up with something else. And so she said, look, you like people, you're good at working with people, why don't you think about maybe becoming a psychologist or a social worker or a teacher or something like that? So I kind of bounced around that idea, and she kind of said, well, look, you better get some experience. So there was a club called the Arch Club, which was like a youth club for people with quote-unquote special needs and normal people, again, quote-unquote. I hate that language, but that's the language that was used at the time, you know? And so I went along, I remember the first evening, and was absolutely terrified. Didn't know anybody, didn't know what to do, stood in the corner and was afraid to talk to anyone. And I remember walking home that evening thinking, okay, this job is just not for me. This isn't something that I should do. But I figured, okay, look, I'll give it one more week. And I went down the next week, and I remember this little girl coming up to me. She had Down syndrome. Elaine, her name was. And she just came up and said hi. And she started talking to me, and that was it. I was head over heels in love, and she introduced me to everybody. So actually one of the, again, trainees or young people or disabled people, whatever language you want to use, actually took me around by the hand and introduced me to everyone. And she integrated me into the club and into their world. And a lot of the guys that went to the Arch Club went to a day care centre called Windmill Therapeutic Training Unit. And it was there that I met my first mentor, a guy called John Carroll, who had been a social worker in the UK and had come back to Ireland to get married, and had sort of brought all of these new ideas that were happening in England but weren't happening here. And I met Deirdre there. I'd applied for to do the childcare course, which is now the social care course in WIT. But at that time, you had to have a year's experience before they would even look at you. Mm-hmm. So I was working in Windmill for the year doing a FOSS course, you know, the old CE schemes. I was doing that. And Deirdre came along one day to become one of the other CE workers. And I remember looking at her across the table thinking, oh, she's a bit of all right, you know. And we didn't, well, actually, I tell a lie. She always says she liked me at first. I didn't like her at all because I thought she talked way too much. She was very noisy, kind of bubbly, sort of in your face kind of person. But the more I got to know her, the more I realised actually I did like her an awful lot. And yeah, it was really, we went out on a first date and we said, okay, this is not going to be serious. We're not going to see each other all the time. And then we saw each other every day for the next 6 months. And I got married when I was 21 and haven't looked back since.
And we're going to talk briefly because there's so much to talk about. But a PhD in 2007 sort of changed your life. Just put a bit of context on that and then we'll play a song and we might get into how it in fact really changed your life.
Okay. I did my degree in WIT. Back then, there was no such thing as a degree in childcare or social care. You did a diploma and then you went out and worked. So I did my diploma, did okay in that. I have to say, I did not excel academically at the diploma because I had a great time in college. I did a lot of parties. I played a lot of music. I had great fun. I had to go back and repeat a couple of my exams, but I got through. And I went out and I worked for 3 years doing residential childcare work, which was, I loved, but it was incredibly tough. And also we had a family at that stage. There was my son. We wanted to have more kids. And I figured doing residential childcare, which is, you know, you're working nights. I worked 3 Christmas days in a row. Not great if you want to have kids. So I went back to college to do my degree, and this is where I discovered actually I'm not thick. I discovered that I actually had a love for academia and kind of sociology in particular, kind of how society works and why it works and why all of the things that are wrong with society are there really interested me. And so I was asked to stay on and continue teaching and do my master's. So I did my master's in youth gangs, which was just a phenomenon that were beginning to evolve in Ireland at the time. And that led on to a desire to do a PhD.
And you know what? I'm going to stop you there because the PhD changed your life so much. I think we'll need a bit of music to build up to this. Your first song is House of the Rising Sun. Yeah. Tell us why you've chosen this one, Shane.
Okay, my mum, when she was pregnant with my sister Tara, decided she was a beautiful singer. She my mum, there's a whole story to my mum which could take up a whole program, and I've actually made programs about her. Was a nun for 10 years, and she ended up having a relationship with the priest who was the chaplain of her order, and the two got kicked out, and she ended up, they didn't stay together, and she ended up meeting my dad. But anyway, she was a beautiful singer. She actually was a soloist for the composer Ray Vaughan Williams. She did the solo for one of his pieces. So beautiful singer. And when she was pregnant with my sister, she decided to learn to play the guitar, and Billy Roach, the great writer and also a musician, lived up the road and he taught her. And a lasting memory that I have of her is sitting in our living room with this beautiful old nylon string guitar, pregnant as anything, with playing the House of the Rising Sun. And she didn't do the Animals version, which she thought was a little bit too loud and raucous. She did the old Josh White version, which is quite sort of much more slow and melodic. But the song, in whichever form, I love them all, always sort of reminds me of her. And I just remember as a kid sitting, looking at her, thinking that she sounded beautiful and looked beautiful. And it's just one of those lovely childhood memories.
They call it the Rising Sun. You know that it's been the home of many a poor boy. In God, I know I'm one. My mother, she was a tailor, and she sewed my new blue jeans. You know my father, he was a gambling man. Way down in New Orleans.
Sunshine Meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
You're very welcome back to Sunshine Meets. If you're just joining me, I'm Andrea Hayes, and my guest tonight is one of Ireland's leading child protection experts. He's known internationally as a best-selling author of a series of books detailing cases he was involved with, both as a social worker and as a journalist. And we're going to talk about that right now. Sunshine Meets Shane Dunphy. Now, Shane, we touched on your PhD back in 2007, but I know that the 40 pages of that became Wednesday's Child, which went to number one in Irish nonfiction. It was on the bestsellers list. But how did you get a book deal? And tell us how that sort of all unfolded.
It unfolded completely by accident. It was not part of my plan at all. I had done, I had done my master's degree, and that had been quite well received. It was quite controversial initially. And I remember there was an article published in the Irish Times that got me in serious trouble with my academic supervisors because people just weren't ready. The whole idea of gangs in Limerick or gangs in certain areas in Dublin was completely unheard of. But when it was finally completed, it was generally accepted that I'd achieved something with it. So I wanted to go straight into the PhD. And my PhD thesis was to be about the experiences of not just children in the care system, but also the staff. What does the experience of living and working in care do to you? Because it does, it changes you in a very real way. So what I was doing was, I was being supervised by a beautiful man called Dr. Arthur Williams, who works in the University of Belfast. And he was another guy. Over my life, I've been very lucky to encounter people who have been real mentors to me and have really helped me to find my voice and find the direction that I wanted to go in. So I was writing, I decided that the structure for my thesis was going to be a chapter of theory backed up by a case study. So chapter of academia followed up by a story. I've always loved stories, and I think stories are a great way to get information out to people. So Arthur was reading these and he said to me, you know, he says, gosh, he said, the bits that I'm really enjoying and the bits that are really, I suppose, making your point are these stories about these kids. And he said to me, I think they warrant publication by themselves. Have you ever thought about trying to put those together into maybe a book? And he said it would be, he felt it would be a good accompaniment to the PhD thesis. Little did he know, God bless him, he was working his way out of a job. So I sent them off to a journal, and they were very well received, and they were kind of published as academic case studies, because you can get journals of those. But Arthur still wasn't happy. He said, no, I think, you know, there's a market for this. People would want to read these. So I remember I wrote to a literary agent who shall remain unnamed in the UK. And I sent them over to him, and I got a letter back almost 2 weeks to the day, which ran, it's the only rejection letter I've ever gotten. And it ran along the lines of, you know, we don't think anybody would be interested in these at all. Please never contact us again. It was something to that effect. I just laughed and I put it in a drawer and forgot about it. And I remember that Christmas, my wife got me the present of a book by a guy called Donal Ruan. And it was Tales in the Rearview Mirror, this taxi driver book, you know. And in the introduction, he said that the staff at Gillam McMillan had been incredibly supportive to him in helping him get this book off the ground. And I thought, you know what, I'll give it one more crack. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. And I remember we were having a dinner party over the Christmas break, and I was in Pettit's supermarket in Wexford. And it just occurred to me, because I was thinking about it as I was going around, and I said, I'm just going to send these on spec. Maybe nobody would be interested. So I had my mobile with me, and I said, while I'm going around shopping, I'll give a phone call to Gillam McMillan. And again, little did I know, over the Christmas break, nobody was likely to be there. But as luck would have it, a lady called Alison Walsh happened to be in the office at the time, and she picked up the phone. And Alison had actually worked in social care in the UK. So when I had the conversation with her, she said, you know, look, there might be an interest. Send it in to me. So I posted it in. I emailed it into her, actually. We didn't even have internet in the house at the time. I had to go to an internet cafe. And I emailed it to her. My wife and I went for lunch, and over lunch, an hour later, I got a call back from her, and she said, I really like these. Do you mind if I show them to someone else? I thought, for God's sake, show them to whoever the hell you want. And a week later, I got a call, and she asked me to come up to Dublin to meet her, and they offered to buy the book on the spot. At that stage, I had no agent. I didn't know anything about the literary world, and I was scared out of my wits as to, I'm going to make a mistake. So luckily, I got some pointers from some friends, and Jonathan Williams became my agent, and the rest, as they say, is history. That was Wednesday's Child. It was the first three case studies in the book, which all I really did was stick in a bit of dialogue and clean them up a bit. And of course, then I had to go away and write the thing. So I wrote it. Over that summer holidays, I got up at 6 o'clock in the morning and wrote until lunchtime. And I finished it in about 3 weeks.
Which is incredible. But I just want to jump you forward a little bit to the reaction, Shane, because your books are bestsellers all over the world. But I'd love to know if that guy ever thought of your name again when a lot of your books did so well in the UK, that first agent.
I have no idea. I haven't spoken to him since. He told me never to contact him again, so yes. I've gone with that. Yeah, When's This Child, I remember... That feeling when you get your book in your hand for the first time, you know it very well. And I was just delighted to have a book. And I thought, okay, some of my friends might buy this. I'll have it on the shelf. And this is brilliant. This is it. This is my job done. And I can just go back to doing other things now that the book is finished. And it came out and I did the promotional circuit and we had our launch, which scared the living daylights out of me. I've never been a big fan of them. I get very nervous, convinced that nobody is ever going to show up. But the launch went really well. Did the promotional thing. Again, Jerry Ryan, who's the second time he's come up in this interview, gave me an hour on his show to talk about it, which I couldn't believe. I kept on getting up to go and he would have another question for me. And I did the Late Late Show, which again, one of those things as a kid in your head, you think, you know, my gosh, if only famous people end up on the Late Late Show. I ended up on the Late Late Show. And I was in Waterford one morning doing a bit of shopping and I got a phone call from my sister saying, have you looked at the paper today? And I said, no. And she said, you're number one on the bestseller list.
Like, and that is incredible. To put that into context, that is a massive achievement.
Yeah.
And it means, and I mentioned this to you, really captured, I suppose, the heart of the nation and the pulse of the nation, and everyone was behind this book that literally came out of nowhere in many respects.
Ireland was going through its boom period at the time, and I think everybody was doing very, very well, but there was still that underculture going on in Ireland. And it's one of the things that I talk about in When's This Child, that there were places in Ireland that never saw the boom. There was places where there had still been multi-generational unemployment, where children had had parents who had never worked and grandparents who had never worked, and that there were people who were living lives, again to quote the famous quote of Quiet Desperation. And I think that there had been books written by those people, but I think often social workers and social care workers get a very bad name. People assume that we are the ones that go sailing into your house to take your children away from you. And what When's This Child was about was showing that, in fact, that isn't the case at all. That generally what we're trying to do is work side by side with these families. And one of the things I really did not want to do, and one of the things I've really stood firm not to do in my books, is to write... It's not, they're not voyeuristic in that they don't dwell on terrible instances of abuse. In my books, I deal with what happens after that has taken place. And they're celebrations of the victories and the accomplishments and the strength of children and families who've been through terrible things and come out the other end. Now, there isn't always happy endings. You know, many of my books deal with the fact that sometimes people don't recover. But I try very hard to show that there is a life afterwards and that people can come back and that children can bounce back from the most appalling things and go on to be tremendous people. And the people I write about in my books, these are my heroes. These are the people that I admire and look up to.
And I think that's why the readers love them so much. It's there's so much of your career that I have to kind of put all in one. But in addition to having best-selling books, you suddenly got catapulted, I suppose, into the media.
Yeah.
Because very often you were finding yourselves doing TV shows, radio interviews. You were the go-to guy. How was that for you, somebody that perhaps wasn't used to that?
It became all-consuming, to be honest with you, for a very long time. I remember somebody saying to me, you know, will I get you in the offices of The Independent? I said, I've actually never been in the offices of The Indo, because I was writing 3 or 4 articles for The Indo every week. I was writing for The Examiner, I was writing for The Sun, the Star. I became kind of the quote-unquote child care expert for a number of different publications. I was doing radio programs, I was standing in for people on various different radio stations. I loved it, and I remember waking up at one point thinking, my gosh, this could all go away in the morning. They're going to find out that actually I'm a complete fraud, and they're not going to ever want to deal with me again. But what did happen was that I reached the point where I wasn't seeing an awful lot of my family, writing books, teaching full time, and pretty much doing full time media, which is what I was doing. And I remember, and this is going to sound terrible, a colleague of mine at a staff meeting. We were at a staff meeting in work, and I was there scribbling away in a notebook, and a colleague actually leaned over and said, "Are you writing a column?" And I was. And I mean, that's shameful. You shouldn't do that. But how do you fit in all of these things? What was happening as well was that I was getting phone calls at 6 o'clock in the morning to inform me that some awful tragedy had befallen. Mm. And they'd be looking for you to get ahead of the curve and get out and find out what had happened and use your contacts within the industry. And I started to feel like a little bit of an ambulance chaser in a way. And I remember just waking up one morning, realizing that I needed to take a step back, that I was missing, you know, so much that was going on around me. I wasn't being in the moment anymore. And I wasn't looking after myself terribly well either. And, you know, you need to, I wasn't living.
Yeah.
I was working. And I was, you know, what I was doing, I still feel that I was doing a lot of good at that time and I was raising a lot of awareness, but I was also, I think, probably coming pretty close to one of these guys that was just going to keel over.
Yeah, no, you were.
Didn't stop.
It was incredible. I mean, and it was great work on TV. I know you did a lot of work even on TV3. Mm. But after all that work, we're going to take a little song now from you. It's Shane's second choice, and it's a song from the Beatles. Tell us why you've chosen this lovely song.
I think, growing up in our house, there was certain music that we heard all the time. My dad listened to opera and traditional Irish music, and my mum listened to the Beatles and Cliff Richard, you know, vintage Cliff, good Cliff. Sorry for any of the more modern Cliff Richards fans. But the Beatles is one of those soundtracks, and this particular song is one that, I can always just remember. My mum used to do an awful lot of needlework and knitting, and she'd be there sitting in the living room, knitting away, and the Beatles, you know, the Blue Album and Red Album, those ones would be playing. And this is one of the songs that always makes me think of that.
This is We Can Work It Out.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone.
Sunshine Meets on Dublin's Easy Place to Relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
Hello there, you're very welcome back to Sunshine Meets. I'm Andrea Hayes, and if you're listening, you know that my guest tonight is one of Ireland's leading child protection experts. He's a journalist, as we heard, a musician, a teacher, but he's probably best known as an international best-selling author. Now, Shane, Sunshine Meets Shane Dunphy. Now, Shane, there's a story I wanted to ask you about. Because Hollywood is calling.
It is.
The rumours are true. What happened with the boy they tried to hide? Because this is quite incredible.
Yeah.
You did a radio interview in the States.
Yeah, The Boy They Tried to Hide is my most recent non-fiction book. There's another one in the pipeline, which I'm kind of working on at the moment. But The Boy They Tried to Hide is the story of kind of an urban myth that sort of proved to be real, proved to actually have been true. So it's one of these kind of stories that kind of happens in a community and nobody's sure whether it's true or not. I suppose that's the background of it, kind of myth becoming reality. And it's a ghost story, really, more than anything else. I've found a couple of times in my career working with kids that children live very close to, I suppose they live in their imagination almost, and sometimes imaginary friends and stuff that maybe adults don't see or stop believing in anymore can be very real for kids. And when you're working with them, you kind of enter into that world. And so it's a little bit about that as well, kind of how sometimes as adults we forget about the world that children live in. So what happened was literally that an American radio producer was in, I think, an airport in London, I think, and she picked up The Boy They Tried to Hide. She was rushing to get to a flight, needed a book, grabbed this one and read it on the flight home and loved it. And she gave me a call and said, would I be interested in doing a storytelling show? It wasn't an interview so much as a storytelling. She wanted me to tell the story, so not read the book, but tell the story. So over a period of about 6 hours, it was really long. Actually, I was surprised at how long the process took. We FaceTimed each other, and she got me to tell the story. And I recorded it myself. I recorded my bits on Pro Tools, which I use to edit my own radio work at home. And then I emailed it to her. And it went out on a show called Snap Judgment, which is on American National Public Radio, and it got an absolutely massive response. Again, I was gobsmacked. When she told me she was doing the show, I assumed it was just this kind of quaint little show that a few people listened to, and, you know, it was nice to be asked. But little did I realise that Snap Judgment has an absolutely... the Americans love their storytelling shows. I suppose they're kind of like adult versions of Jack and Ori, maybe something a little bit like that. And it was one of the most downloaded podcasts that they had. It went out as part of their Spooked series, which is kind of like broadcast over Halloween. So I was really thrilled with this, and I got a great reaction. I got loads of positive feedback on social media, and again, I wandered off and thought nothing more of it. And one evening, quite late, my wife and I were watching, you know, that show on Netflix, The Crown, you know, the one about the British royal family. And the next thing, my phone pinged, and I opened it up, and it was a message request on Facebook from an American independent movie producer. And she said, you know, look, she'd made a documentary I'd really loved about the musician and artist Daniel Johnston. And she said, would I be interested in talking to her about doing this, doing the story, The Boy They Tried to Hide, as a film? And I said, be Jesus, I would. That sounds great. But as it happened, she ended up getting doing something else. But while I was waiting for her, several other producers got in contact. The story just grabbed people, and eventually I settled with a production company called Rumble Films. And this is David Lancaster and Stephanie Wilcox. They are responsible for films like Drive with Ryan Gosling, and Nightcrawler with Jake Gyllenhaal, and Eye in the Sky with Alan Rickman and Helen Mirren. And they're currently making a movie called Donnybrook, which is based on a book by the American, I hate this term, but again, publishing has these, it's redneck noir, basically, set in kind of the American wilderness, so to speak, and it deals with a bare-knuckle boxing tournament, and my movie's next after that.
Which is just incredible, and all of this is happening just as you try to then change a complete direction in your career. And
It's funny how these things happen, kind of the universe plays funny tricks on you. I had a conversation with my publishers about the fact that, yeah, I've been doing the non-fiction, the misery-lit books now for 10 years, and they're still selling and people still love them. And I mean, I'm so happy with what I've achieved with those books. But I had a conversation with my publishers a couple of years ago, and I said, you know, look, I've been living with this stuff in my head now for a really long time, and it'd be nice to sort of try something else. And I'd had a story, a kind of a mystery story, a crime story that I'd wanted to do for a while. And Kira Durley, who's my editor, is such a brilliant person. And she just said, but look, I tell you what, plot it out for me. But she didn't even say plot it out. She said, tell me about your characters. Who would your characters be? Who would the protagonists be? And let's start with that. Because she knew damn well I'd never written a novel before. And writing nonfiction, because of the fact you don't have to make it up, it's easy. Whereas a novel, you have to create the whole world that these guys are going to live in, and you need to know who they are. So I sat down one afternoon and just started writing, and the characters just all... it was like they jumped out. It was like I'd opened a door in my head and they climbed out onto the page. And they were fully formed and they surprised me. I didn't know they were in there. And Keir was amazing because initially David Dunnigan, who was the lead character in it, he's a criminologist. Initially I had him as a social care worker. It never even occurred to me to do anything else. And Keir said, I really think we need to try something else. So what else could he be? And so... He became a criminologist who does consultancy work with the Sex Crimes Unit of the National Bureau of Criminal Investigation, which would be the Irish equivalent of the FBI. Mm-hmm. And those guys were absolutely amazing and let me hang out with them and visit their offices and chatted to me about what it's like doing the work that they do. So I've been very lucky to be able to reproduce that quite accurately in the books. And After She Vanished, which was the first novel, was... again, to my huge surprise, really well received, and went to into the bestseller lists at number 11 and hung around in the top 20 for months.
Which is incredible. And it's quite interesting for me because actually when your first book came out, Wednesday's Child, there was people calling from TV and film. And I suppose maybe naivety or just your nervousness, you didn't want to commit back then. And it's quite coincidental that it's taken this time.
I was an arsehole, Andrea, to be quite honest with you. Some really good, very patient people sat and had very long meetings with me in which they must have wanted to punch me about the head. Because, you see, back then, I didn't have a clue. I didn't realise that what you've got in a book is not going to translate to what's going to come out onto the screen. And it can't, because books are written and presented in a particular way, whereas film has to be done differently. Right now, there's a very talented scriptwriter working on the boy they tried to hide. And I know who he is, and he's done some great stuff for Netflix, and he's an up-and-coming British guy. And I'm not going to interfere with that at all. Elmore Leonard, the great crime writer, has a brilliant thing about when you're selling the rights of a book. He says that when a writer sells the rights for a book, they should meet the film producers on either side of an enormous big fence. And the writer should throw their book over, and the film producer should throw over a big bag of money, and then you should walk away and never see each other again. And I think that there's some truth in that now with The Boy They Tried to Hide. They've been very kind, and they've allowed me to be a script consultant.
Oh, fantastic.
Meaning, I presume they'll show me the script and I'll make comments which they will probably ignore, which will be fine. But they've also allowed, because it is a film about me doing child protection mm-hmm. work, they've allowed me to be a child protection consultant on it as well. So I still get to be there and annoy them when they're actually making it.
Which is incredible. But for Wednesday's Child, could have been in a movie.
It could have been. The problem is what they wanted to change things.
Yeah.
And they wanted to, it was the BBC Northern Ireland had contacted me about doing a mini-series, basically. Mm. It was going to be one of those short drama things. And I saw some of the names recently, actually, in a really good series. That one was Sean Bean, where he was the priest. It was the same people who
yes.
made that. So I was watching that thinking, what could have been? But you see, they wanted to change things. They wanted to soften it a little bit because they said some of the plots were just too harsh for TV. And me being the precious guy that I was, said, no, absolutely not. You cannot change things. It has to be exactly the way that I've got written. I will protect my creation. And of course, eventually they just got completely pissed off and walked away and said, we're not dealing with that eejit.
But it's all come back again. It feels like it's meant to be, because not only yeah. is your non-fiction, but also now the fiction perhaps could have another life, maybe on
possibly,
the big screen.
Yeah, possibly. Again, as I said, producers have come knocking, they're reading stuff. I don't know whether anything will come of that. But it's just, with me, these things are always, it's lovely to be asked. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel very privileged to have been able to do the things that I do. I feel privileged to be sitting here chatting to you now, and that you're interested, or that anybody might be interested in listening to kind of my story and how I've got to where I'm going.
Well,
and
it has been our privilege. Sunshine has met Shane Dunphy, and we could meet him again next week and possibly the week after, and we'll only scratch the surface. You're still writing, you're still playing music, you're still doing all of the things that you're
doing. I am indeed, yeah. I mean, I was playing music last night in The Sky on the Ground on Maxford with Kevin and Tom, my musical cohorts, and I'm still teaching full time as well, and I love that, and life is good.
What's your website if anybody wants to connect and find out more?
I don't have a website per se. I'm on social media, so I just look for Shane Dunphy on social media, and I think it's Dunphy Shane 1 on Twitter or something. I'm still getting to grips with the social media thing. It's brilliant, and it has been a great avenue to get the books out there and to talk to my readers, but I have a very good person who's working on a website at the moment, so I'll keep you posted on that.
Very good. Well, your last song is from Bob Dylan. Tell us why you've chosen this, Shane Dunphy.
I was really late coming to Bob Dylan, and a very good friend of mine, Sandra, introduced me to him, and she made me a mixtape. Remember the mixtapes from the 80s? And I remember she made it for me, and I came home and stuck it on the stereo and switched off all the lights, and I lay down on the living room floor in the dark. And I remember this song was the second song that she had on the tape, and it just blew my mind, and it still does every time I hear it.
Sunshine meets Shane Dunphy. This is Don't Think Twice, wrapping up our show this evening.
Well, it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, even you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, it'll never do somehow. When your rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm traveling on, but don't think twice, it's alright. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, baby, the light I never knowed. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, baby. I'm on the dark side of the road. But I wish there was something you would do or say to try and make me change my mind and stay. But we never did too much talking anyway. But don't think twice, it's all right. So it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, like you never done before. And it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, I can't hear you anymore. I'm a-thinking and a-wondering, walking down the road. I once loved a woman, a child, I'm told. I give her my heart, but she wanted my soul. But don't think twice, it's all right. So long, honey, baby, where I'm bound, I can't tell. Goodbye is too good a word, baby, so I just say fairly well. I ain't saying you treated me unkind. You could have done better, but I don't mind. You just kind of wasted my precious time. Don't think twice, it's all right.